For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, tonight we start the last four classes, the next section of our course. We only have four left, believe it or not. I know, only four left. And as I was preparing this, I was thinking to myself, you know, the Zionist, the anti-Zionist, there's no way to cover this in 1 week. And then I remembered that when we set up the course, and I actually set up four different classes to address this topic. What we're going to do tonight is going to be really scratching the surface. We're going to cover what will really serve as an introduction to the next three classes as we lay the groundwork for what is, as we now begin the 20th century. All of the controversies that we've been discussing up until this point have taken us up until the early 1900s. And now we're going to hit the 1900s. We're going to work through the controversies that affect us the most in our lives, and what is clearly, without question, the greatest overall controversy of our lifetimes, which is how to deal with the modern state of Israel. How does this fit into Jewish theology? Where does this fit? What place does it take? 2,500 years of exile, and now the Jewish people have returned to our land, except the return hasn't quite been according to the script that the Jewish people have been waiting for 2,500 years. So it creates a real lack of clarity how to deal with it. And as we'll see, there have been a number of approaches, and that has given rise to a great number of controversies which we continue to live through until this very day. Those of you following the news as to what's going on currently in the land of Israel with the army and with other issues is literally just an outgrowth of everything that we're going to be talking about over the next couple of weeks. So we'll have a little chance to better understand that which is going on, hopefully, with some of these classes. And I hope that I will do it justice, as it is really, really complex. But I'm going to say from the beginning, I'm not simplifying because I don't think you can handle more, but because I couldn't prepare more. It is so complex, the concept of Zionism. Today, in the modern-day world, Zionism means almost nothing what it did before. It's so many different groups have splintered out of what was the original Zionist movement. So we're going to try to do the impossible, which is put us back pre-Holocaust, into the early 1900s, beginning of the Zionist movement. The reason why that's impossible is because the Holocaust changed everything about the Zionist movement, the way that we deal with it, because it was such a cataclysmic event in the Jewish world, and it happened 40 years after the Zionist movement was born, and now all of a sudden, right after the Holocaust, the state is born. It changed the way that we deal with it. It didn't take away the controversy, not at all. It just changed it. We're going to have to go back and try to take ourselves out of our modern-day approach and go back into as it began and try to understand as best we can. So with that little introduction, again, what I'm saying tonight, everything is more complex than what I'm saying, but we're going to try to do it as best we can. So let's start with what I have in the beginning of your notes. Where are you? I'm going to give you a series of phrases, and you tell me where you fit. I don't need to actually know, but you find out for yourself. Where do you fit on this list in the first box on the top of your page, on page one? How do you view the modern state of Israel, as it is currently? Not what you want it to be, not what it should be. As it is. These are all actual phrases which are used today to describe the modern state. I didn't make these up. It's a satanic act, meaning it's based on the Satan, the Sahara, it's evil. I'm going to give a little explanation to each phrase. It is the embodiment of evil. Or, next, we're going from the most vile to the most sublime. That's how the list is going to go. You'll see it's going to progress from that. But do we view it as an act of the Yetzer Hara, it's evil? Or is it just an anti-Jewish state? Meaning, it's not necessarily evil, the embodiment of evil, but it goes against everything Jewish and it's there to try to be an anti-Jewish entity. Number three, it's a regime which calls itself Israel. It's not quite evil or anti-Jewish, it's just an imposter. It's calling itself the State of Israel, but it doesn't actually represent what the State of Israel should be. It does not represent what a Jewish state should be. So it's just a regime which calls itself Israel. Is it a state ruled by Jews? It's just another state. There are lots of states in the world, lots of countries. And this one happens to be ruled by Jews. Is it the state of the Jews? This is our state. Is it the state of the Jewish people? It represents the embodiment. A little similar to the previous one, the state of the Jewish people. Is it the pedestal of God's throne in this world? Is it a divine state? If you have to choose, circle one. How do you, where are you on this spectrum? Where do you, how do you view the modern state today? What would you circle in understanding how to view it? Show of hands, how many of you circled a state ruled by Jews? Zero. How many of you circled the state of the Jews? Few. State of the Jewish people? Pedestal of God's throne in this world? Few. Very good. You got a real Zionist. All right. And a divine state? All the way. Excellent. Okay. This is a simple thing. This was a very simple exercise, but if you see, if you paid attention across the room, we don't have anything close to a consensus as to how to conceptualize what is taking place today in the land of Israel. Just to conceptualize it, what is it? There's a wide range of, well, it's just a state run by Jews. Jewish state, is it actually the seat of God's presence? Is it actually a divine state? Those are different approaches, and we're going to go back now in time and try to understand it. Okay, so in answer to my question of, are you a Zionist? So again, in today's modern terminology, that phrase means very little. But if I were to ask, in the early 1900s, are you a Zionist? Be a tough question. The Zionism, the concept, look up, what is Zionism, was a political and national movement that was born in the late 1800s under the leadership of Theodor Herzl to establish a Jewish national homeland. That is what Zionism was. A movement to create a home for the Jewish people. Now, the Jewish people's love of the land of Israel as a national and religious homeland, that was actually born with God's promise to Avraham Avinu way back before then. Some 3,000, 4,000 years prior to Theodor Herzl, we have the concept of God giving Avraham the land of Israel, saying to you and to your children, this is going to be their inheritance. He repeats that promise to Yitzchak, he repeats that promise to Yaakov, and that is our yearning. That has nothing to do with Zionism. That's because a Jew is intrinsically attached to the land of Israel, because that is the land that Hashem gave us to live in. That is the land that He gave us to connect to Him in. It is our homeland. That's no politics. That's just a belief system. As the Ramban holds, Nachmanides, early Rishonim in the period 1194, he lived in the 1200s. It's a mitzvah for every Jew to dwell in the land of Israel. Just part of our genetic DNA. It's part of our spiritual DNA. Zionism was a movement that said in the late 1800s, it's time for us to go back and set up a national homeland. Now, whether or not you agree on the how, on the when, that's a matter of theology, politics. We can discuss, we can debate as it was done. What gets confused is a person can say, I'm an anti-Zionist. Again, we're going back. We're not talking today. We're talking in the early 1900s. I'm an anti-Zionist and I love the state of Israel. That's not a contradiction. I'm an anti-Zionist because I don't believe that we should be setting up a state homeland for us today. But I love the land of Israel because Hashem gave it to us. That's where we're supposed to be. Maybe we're not supposed to go now. And that's not at all a contradiction. Today in our ears, that sounds weird. You're an anti-Zionist and you love the state, that you love the land of Israel? Yes, I love the land of Israel. I'm not into creating a state of Israel. Not for now. Confusing to separate those two concepts, but they have to be separated because they really are not at all together, because the early Zionists didn't care about God's promise to Abraham as being the land of the Jewish people to connect to God in. That wasn't their agenda. As we're going to see, it was a socialist agenda. It was an agenda to protect the Jewish people from discrimination, from persecution. It was to make them like the other nations of the world, and it did not have any religious concept. So we have to separate the fact that a Jew loves the land of Israel and wants to be in the land of Israel from the Zionist political movement to establish a national homeland for the Jewish people. Now, before we begin this discussion, there's a Gemara in Maseches Ksuvos, which is quoted by everybody who talks about this, which we have to put out on the table, because we're going to reference it many, many times. It's a very tricky Gemara. It's a pretty short Gemara. I've quoted it for you in the second box here on the page. And the Gemara says as follows: when the Jewish people were sent into exile, God, so to speak, made them promise or swear to three oaths. It's as if these are the terms of the exile. And the Gemara records there were three terms of the exile that the Jewish people and the world at large agreed to, that when the Jewish people would be in their exile, these are the terms. And they go as follows. What are these three oaths? One, that Israel should not rise like or with a wall, which is vague, and therefore lends itself to many different understandings. The Jewish people cannot rise up like a wall. Number two, that God had Israel swear not to rebel against the nations. So that while we're in the exile, we have taken an oath not to rebel and not to rise up with like a wall, which most commentators understand meaning in retaking Israel. We're not going to come en masse like a wall. We're not going to rebel against the nations of the world. We'll live peacefully amongst our host countries. And number three was an oath that the nations of the world took, which was not to subjugate Israel too much. Now, based on your reaction, I could tell you that there are many who say, since the nations of the world didn't keep their part of the bargain, we're not obligated to keep our part of the bargain. We'll leave that aside for now. We'll get back to that at the end. In any case, these are the three oaths. These three oaths are known as a piece of Gemara called Agadata, which we've discussed in many, many occasions. It's a debate whether or not, is this halachic? Is this Jewish law? Or is this Jewish thought? Has this been put in place so that the Jewish people have a way to relate to the exile? Don't storm back. Wait till you're called. You may not rise up like a wall to take it. You may not rebel against the nations of the world. You sit and wait until I call you. We're going to see there are many interpretations of this Gemara, but you cannot have a discussion about the early Zionist movement without this Gemara, because we're going to see how the different groups dealt with it. But this was part of Jewish thought, Jewish culture, for 2,500 years, that part of the exile was not storming our way back, not rebelling against the nations of the world in which we are hosted. And then the nations of the world have their oath not to subjugate us too much, which, whatever that was worth. How do you reconcile this on a simple level? The Ramban, I quoted a moment ago, understands that every Jew has a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. I have a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel, and I have an oath not to storm it like a wall. So for thousands of years, it was all right, so an individual can go, but the Jewish people en masse were not going to go. So any individual can. The Ramban himself went. Many individuals, Jews, went. And it never seemed to be a problem with this particular Gemara, because nobody was storming the walls of Yerushalayim. It was individuals who would go and live. And there was a constant presence of Jewish people in the land of Israel from the time of the destruction until today. There were always Jews who went. We just didn't ever have mass movement. But this is all going to change. And with this, let's get into the pre-Zionist Zionism. Before that, Zionism was born in 1893. First time the word appears is in the early 1890s. Theodore Herzl doesn't coin define the movement. Late 1800s. However, already in the 1700s, we're going to start having the trickle of Jews back. And it's important to understand the backdrop of what's going on before we get to the actual Zionists. In the 1700s, the land of Israel was described universally by everybody who shows up as completely barren. No economy to speak of, destitute, desolate. There are many who refer to the verse, the Torah itself describes, when I'm going to kick you out of the land will not give forth its fruit to the nations that occupy her until you return. We're seeing that today in our day and age. The Jews have come back and the land is just alive with greenery, with fruits, with vegetation. But it was a desolate place, completely barren, uninhabitable for hundreds of years, throughout the 1700s and up to that point. The population was a modest Sephardic population. The Sephardim came, remember when? after the Spanish Inquisition, they were booted out of Spain, Portugal, one country after another. So they thought, if you remember, one of the themes we've been tracing is the Messianic theme, which began in earnest in the 1300s and 1400s with the Spanish Inquisition. This must be the end. The Messiah must be coming because this is so horrible. And a large group of Jews emigrated to the land of Israel. They began to prepare for the coming of the Mashiach. We had an entire class, if you remember, last year. They recreated Smicha in order to have a Beis Din. They were getting ready. But they didn't survive. The Sephardic community it was uninhabitable. Plague killed them out. A few moved back to Yerushalayim. The community in Tzfat was very small. At best, a few thousand Jews were in the land of Israel as we get to the 1700s. There was always a group of Yerushalmis, those who had been there forever, and a bunch of Sephardim. It was mainly Sephardim who were at that time indigenous to the land. Ashkenazim had not come. And that's where we find the Jewish people in the mid-1700s. However, as we get towards the end of the 1700s, there's this organic trickle of Jews that begin to emigrate to the land of Israel. Ashkenazim, coming from Russia, Poland, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, if you remember, and I say this every class, why would you think Jews would begin to emigrate to the land of Israel during the 1700s from these lands? It was hard. I'm sure whatever you said is what I would want you to say. It was horrible. Life was just terrible. So they began to come. It was a place to go. There was always the yearning of the Jewish people to return to the land of Israel. We davened for it all the time. The Shana Haba Yerushalayim was on their lips every year at the end of Yom Kippur, every year at the end of their Pesach Seder. There was this yearning to go back. And there began a trickle, a steady trickle of Ashkenazic Jews from these European lands to settle in the lands of Palestine. It began with the disciples of the Gaon of Vilna. We discussed the Vilna Gaon himself, who lived in the 1720s to 1797. He himself tried to go, and he encountered great difficulty along the way. He encountered legal difficulty, he got sick, one thing after another, and he says on himself, "Min hashamayim ichvuhi," from heaven they stopped me. They didn't want me going in heaven, and one thing after another, and he turned back. He went back to Vilna, but his disciples came. His disciples set up a community in Jerusalem, in Shari Chesed, which still exists today, and the main minhagim of Yerushalayim until today, of the Ashkenazic community, are based on the Vilna Gaon's customs, because his followers were the first disciples to come and resettle, the first Ashkenazic Jews to come and resettle. This is back in the 1700s, 150 years before anyone ever thought of Zionism. Then the disciples of the Baal Shem Tov came. Now the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon, if you remember, were mortal enemies. The Hasidim versus the Misnagdim. The Vilna Gaon was ahead of the Misnagdim, those opposed to the Hasidim. The Baal Shem Tov was the creator of the Hasidim. And his disciples also come to Eretz Yisrael in the mid-1700s. They settle both in Hebron and Yerushalayim. And as Rabbi Beryl Wine likes to point out, somehow they left the controversy behind in Europe, probably because of their need for survival. Because life was so uninhabitable, the country was uninhabitable, there was no economy to speak of, so they made it, they lived together in the land. It's funny to think that way. Today, Israel is the hotbed for all sorts of conflict. In the beginnings of the settlement, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, who out in Europe couldn't stand each other, found a way to get along in the land of Israel. They were followed by disciples of the Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer of Pressburg, also in the 1830s, and a strong Ashkenazic community begins to develop by the mid-1800s. By 1846, Jews are the majority of the inhabitants of Yerushalayim already. So in 1846, it's already a Jewish city. By 1860, over 50,000 Jews are living in the land of Israel. So by the late 1700s, there's a small handful of Sephardic Jews. By 1860, 60 years later, there's that steady trickle has turned into a stream. We have over 50,000 Jews living in the land of Israel by this point of time. However, the country could not support them. There was absolutely no economy to speak of. And the Jews survived based on what was known as a chalukah. Chalukah, I think we discussed once or twice before. Jews from around the world would send money to Israel. They would collect, every Jew had a little pushka, Rameir Balanes, in his home, and they would put their little zlotas or whatever they had into it, and then each little town would give it to their little rav, and the little rav of the little town would give it to the rav of the bigger town next door to him, and that rav would then give it to the rav of the big city, and the rav of the big city would find a way to get it to Eretz Yisrael. Why do I say find a way? Because if he was living in Russia, for example, it was illegal to send money out of the country, and particularly to send it to the Turks, who were their archenemies. And we mentioned before, every single Rav in almost all of Europe was constantly living illegally, in violation of the law of his land, and was always liable to being arrested. And when we studied the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, both sides used to use that against the other, because it was true. Each side was in violation of the law, because you're not allowed to send money. But that's how the Jews survived. It was always, you think it's not just today that we send money to Israel. Today you're thinking, why are these guys converting? Oh, that's been around for hundreds of years already. The Jewish people of the exile always supported the Jews who are living in the land of Israel. And it's an old story that the Jews in Israel couldn't support themselves without help from the diaspora. It's not new. It's not just last night that they're knocking on your door. This is an old story. And that's how they lived by what's called the chalukah. It's called the chalukah because the leaders of the Jewish community in the land of Israel would get the money, and then they would divide it out amongst the people living there. So this system was always illegal, it was never enough, and it was never fair. Because it just wasn't. We'd like to think everything was perfect in a utopian society. It just wasn't. The people who came from communities that had more money would get more money. People had more connections would get more. It just was. It was not a great system that was in place, but that was the city that was in place. Rabbi Wein likes to point out that in Israel at the time, the Ottoman Empire was the old man of Europe. Everybody, however you would refer to it, was teetering on the brink of collapse. And so everybody wanted to get a piece, and Palestine was always a very enviable piece of land because of where it sits. So almost all of the foreign nations had they didn't call it an embassy then, but whatever exactly they had, in Jerusalem during the late 1800s. And they would all be protective of their Jews. Now, which means, not because they cared about the Jews, but because they cared about having a foothold in the city and in the country, because they all wanted to take it over from the Turks. So you would have a very funny situation if the Jew living in Russia, who was confined to a certain land, who was persecuted mercilessly by the Tsar, but as soon as that Jew managed to escape Russia and get to Yerushalayim, the Tsar would protect him and his interests from all the other countries, because he wanted a strong Russian presence in the land of Israel. And in one of the many ironies of history, that was the reality of life in Jerusalem in the late 1800s. But in any case, moving along, this is where we get to Sir Moises Montefiore, begins purchasing land all around Yerushalayim and developing them. The land, at that time, the Jews would live inside the walls of the city because it was not safe to live or sleep outside the walls. At night, they would come back into the walls, and during the day, they would be out either working and developing the fields, and the land begins to be purchased by these various visionaries. Already in the 1800s, there are major theological debates. There was a Rav by the name of Yehuda Alkali who lived in the throughout the 1800s. He died in 1878. In 1834, this is 50, 60 years before Zionism, writes a book in which he urges all the European Jews to come back to the land of Israel, telling them that they're not going to make it in Europe, that Europe has no future for the Jewish people. It's prophetic what his words were. He describes, don't worry, we're not taking it by force, we're not in violation of the Gemara, which I quoted earlier, because look, the Turks will buy our money at will. If you give them money, they're so happy to sell their land. There's nothing taking place by force. Come, this is the place to be. And he writes a book trying to inspire the Jews to return. And there is no vision of a state. He wasn't talking any messianic. He was simply saying, Europe is a dead end for the Jews. Come now. At the exact same time that he's writing that book, a Rav by the name of Rav Moshe Teitelbaum, who was the Eiler Rav, I think is the way you pronounce that, not the way that it's spelled, but that's how it's spelled. Eiler Rav in Hungary was a big Talmud Chacham. He wrote a sefer called the Yitzmach Moshe, as he's known by. His nephew becomes the Teitelbaum, who became in Satmar, as we'll learn in a few moments, one of the most vehemently opposed anti-Zionists. But this is before you could be an anti-Zionist, because there's no concept of Zionism. But he writes a book against Rav Yehuda Alkali's book, saying, absolutely not, you may not leave the land that you live in to go back to the land of Israel. It is forbidden to leave before Mashiach comes and takes us back. This is an old debate. This did not start in the 1900s. In the 1800s, before there's a movement called Zionism, there's already rabbinic debate. Are you allowed? Are you forbidden? Do you have to go? Protect yourself. Come back home. versus you're not allowed to leave the home that you are in right now. You can't go. You have to wait. That already begins. In the late 1800s, the 1860s, there's a group called the Chovavei Tzion, the Lovers of Zion, that's founded by the Netziv, and Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. Volozhin was the premier yeshiva in all of Europe. In all of Europe, Volozhin was the Harvard University of Yeshivas. Its head founds a group called the Chovavei Tzion, the Lovers of Zion, which is based on encouraging settlement of the land of Israel, that it should be viable, that it should be young, it should be economically strong, and again, with no state, no political, no messianic agenda. Just, we have to get out of Europe. He was in Volozhin in Russia. The yeshiva is about to be shut down. 1890 is the end of the yeshiva. He's a few years before that. Starting the Chovavei Tzion, let's get the Jews back. Now, he had a double program with the Chovavei Tzion. Number one was that people should move. That's what they wanted. Physically, they wanted to get young people. I have this in my notes. I didn't mention it earlier. Most of the people in the original yeshuv, in the original settlements in the late 1700s and early 1800s were all old people. And the reason why they were all old is because you couldn't live there. It wasn't a place to raise a family. There was no economy. There were no schools. But you would go there to die, literally. Because the sages have so many statements about the benefits of dying and being buried in the land of Israel, today we have the best of both worlds. People live out their life and they die in comfort in America. And then we just ship the body over and we can bury them over there. That didn't work in Europe in the 1700s. If you died in Poland, you were going to be buried in Poland. And if you died in Russia, you're going to be buried in Russia. But if you wanted to be buried in the land of Israel, so you didn't do what we do today, which is you just prepay for your flight and a plot in the land of Israel, you have to actually die in the land of Israel. So the community in Israel was the place where you went to die. It was the first hospice of its day in Jerusalem. That's where people wanted to die. Because the Jews had always felt a strong connection. They wanted to die and be buried in the land of Israel, so you had to live there. But you couldn't live there if you were still raising a family. You couldn't live there. There was nothing to do. So the Chovavei Tzion were bent on, we're going to make this into a viable place. We're going to create youth. We're going to create schools. We're going to create a place where people, it can grow. And they were going to enhance, the second part of the program was enhancing the fundraising capabilities to allow that to happen. You need money to make that happen. So they needed to do a much more concerted fundraising effort to develop the infrastructure of the city. So one of the incidents, one of the famous successes of the Chovavei Tzion was by a Rav named Shmuel Moeliver, who was the Rav of Bialystok. And he was a Talmud Chacham, he was a Yiddish-speaking, bearded, old-school Rav, but he was obsessed with the resettlement of the land of Israel. That just became his thing. Now again, in our modern world, there are certain things that don't fit. There's like an image that we don't see involved with. But this is before then. This is just the old school, old fashioned Rav was obsessed that Jews need to go back. And he, who does not speak a word of French, he was just passionate about this, got himself a meeting with the Baron Rothschild, who was the modern, French-speaking, wealthy Baron, and solicited him in Yiddish, to support the settlement of the land of Israel. And even though they didn't speak the same language, but the language of the heart you can speak. And he made his appeal, and the Baron Rothschild completely bought into the settling of the land of Israel. And his name, the Rothschild family name, is everywhere in the land of Israel. He made a lifelong commitment to supporting the yeshuv. They purchased land, they set up colonies, the Knesset, there are entire building cities that the Baron developed. And he wrote in his will to his children that he considers it one of his greatest accomplishments that God gave him the ability to be involved in the Jewish return to the land of Israel. And that was the Chovavei Tzion. This is in the late 1800s, the beginning of the resettlement of the yeshuv. One of the things that the Baron Rothschild did is set up the first winery, Carmel Winery, in the land of Israel. He had a winery in France, and he set up one in, he brought over vines and grapes, and he set up a winery in the land of Israel. I mentioned this before in other contexts. The very first bottle that Carmel Winery produced, they sent back to Volozhin to give to the Netziv, who had founded the Chovavei Tzion. And the Netziv's son, nephew, writes in his biography of the Netziv that when the bottle arrived, the Netziv went and put on his big day Shabbos. He put on his Shabbos clothes to greet the first
bottle of wine to be produced by the land of Israel in 2,000 years by Jews. 2,000 years, and now a bottle of wine has arrived from the land of Israel. And he went to go put on his Shabbos clothes to greet the first bottle of wine. That's how great Jews understood what it was like to be back in the land of Israel. But shortly after they began to settle, they ran into a significant problem known as, a significant halachic issue known as Shemitah. Every 7 years, the land has to lay fallow. So they weren't sure what to do, how to handle that. Can this fledging community of Jews in this new land that's desolate and barren, can they possibly survive without being able to work the land? So another great controversy erupts. What do we do? So Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, who was one of the leading gedolim of the time, came up with a way to make this permissible. He was going to sell the land to the non-Jewish Arabs. And then the Jew would be permitted to work the land because it's not Jewishly owned. And then they'll be able to live off of the produce. And that's the plan that they were going to do for the Shemitah. It's known today as the Heter Mechira, the permissibility of selling the Jewish land to a non-Jew, then you continue working it. The Netziv did not agree with that psak. He did not agree with that solution. And he withdrew from the Chov of Eitz Zion over this issue. And eventually the Chov of Eitz Zion fell into the non-religious hands, and it became a non-religious secular institution, and then eventually morphed and joined in eventually with the regular Zionist movement. But all of this was what's going on. That issue today, by the way, is still an issue until today as to whether or not you can eat. If you ever end up in Israel over the course of a Shemitah year or the year following the Shemitah year, you'll find, like all things in Israel, are very confusing. You'll find fruit stands that say, you know, you can buy from it, but only if you hold of the Heter Mechira. If you hold from the Heter Mechira, which this is food that was originally land owned by a Jew, and they sold it to a non-Jew, because there's a lot of halachic debate whether or not that works. If it's a Jew, if you just sold it to the non-Jew now, maybe it still has the laws of Shemitah, it's a whole to do, we're not going to get into it now. But until today, this is still an issue which began, many of the people who accepted it back then, so today they would say, yeah, they accepted it back then, but only because they wouldn't have survived. But today we'll be able to survive, we have enough infrastructure, we'll be okay. It's still a major to-do. In any case, moving on, we get to Zion. All of this was just backdrop to understand what was already in place in the land of Israel before Theodor Herzl comes onto the scene. He comes onto the scene in 1893. He's an assimilated Hungarian Jew. He is so assimilated, his own son does not give him a bris milah, no bar mitzvah, no nothing in their home as far as anything Jewish goes. He actually was an editor. He wrote for a paper in Vienna, and he addressed the Jewish problem. The Jewish problem was not something that Hitler created. The Jewish problem was already throughout Europe. The mayor of Vienna, I'm sure he wasn't actually called the mayor, won his position on an openly anti-Semitic platform of kicking all the Jews out of Vienna. This is in the late 1800s. Hitler just cashed in on all that was going on. But there was a Jewish problem that needed to be dealt with in Europe already years before. Theodor Herzl's first solution that he published in his paper was, I think all Jews should march down to the church and become baptized. That's the solution to the Jewish problem. This is our founder of the Zionist movement. His first attempt at solving the Jewish problem was just to become baptized. But he changed his mind when he was sent to cover the Dreyfus Affair. The Dreyfus Affair in France, there was a general, or I don't know if he was a captain in the French army, who was accused of treason. Turns out the whole thing was trumped up charges because he was a Jew. And here is Herzl, and he's covering this case. And in France, the land of freedom and liberty and brotherhood, and the mobs in the streets are screaming, death to the Jews and death to the Jews. So Herzl came to the realization that the Jewish problem needs to be addressed. And his understanding as to why there was a Jewish problem is because we are not normal. The Jewish nation is not normal. We're not like everybody else. We don't have a country. We don't have a government. We don't have a flag. We don't have an Olympic team. We're not like everybody. If we would only be like everybody else, they would think that we're normal, and they would leave us alone. That was his solution. History has proven that wrong. But in any case, that's what he believed. And he founded the Zionist movement, which was a national movement to create a state of our own. It was going to be a homeland. It was going to be ours. It was going to be our own government. We were going to be like everybody else. And it was not critical to him
in the early years, that it be in the land of Palestine. Because that's not part of it. The thing is, we need to be just normal. Instead of being these parasites in other people's lands, we need to be our own people. So, wherever it may be. So, in the World Zionist Congress of 1903, he suggested, let's go to Uganda. We'll have land there. He was going to get from the British land in Uganda. And that was just as well to him as the land of Palestine, because we'll become normal in Uganda. We'll have a country, we'll have a nation, we'll have a flag and an Olympic team, and we'll be living in the land of Uganda. The World Congress did not accept it. He actually died very shortly afterwards. Together with his death was the death of this particular idea. Most of the Zionists and the early Zionists were opposed to what he wanted to say, but I bring it up simply because the founder of Zionism would have been okay with it, because it had nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with the return of the Jewish people to their land. It has to do with resolving the anti-Semitic problems that the Jewish people had, and the best way to do that in his mind was to become normal. Interestingly, Nathan Birnbaum is the one who actually named Zionism Zionism. He was an early follower of the Zionist movement, and he later became disenfranchised. He actually was one of the original, what we would call today, a Baal Tshuva, and he became traditionally observant again, and he actually then became very instrumental in the founding of Agudas Yisrael. So he went from the naming of Zionism, which is an early secular anti-religious movement, and then he ended up joining later in his life Agudas Yisrael, and he is credited with actually founding the name of giving it its name, Zionism, which was connecting it to Zion, connecting it to the land of Israel. Yeah.
Was the term Zionism used even when it could have been any country besides Palestine?
So the word Zionism came in the mid-1800s. The late 1890s is what I meant to say. In the late 1890s, already you have that term Zionism. In the early 1890s, you already have that term. It's 10 years after that that Herzl suggests, well, you know what, let's give up on Zion, let's just do it in Uganda. So that name already had been identified with the movement, and then he suggests, well, let's just go somewhere else into it, because it's not going to work in Zion? Zion. Zion is the name that we find in Tanakh for Yerushalayim. Yes. The colors, blue and white, of course, come from the Tchelet. There was a lot of the original Zionists were not, it was still connected a lot with old traditional things. However, the bottom line was the early Zionists were all anti-religious, they were socialists, and they were determined to create, in their own words, a new Jew. This was going to be a new entity. We were going to shed the Jew of the exile, the Jew of persecution, the Jew that the nations of the world hated, and we're going to make him like him. He was going to be young, he was going to be strong and youthful, he was going to be productive, he was going to use his hands, he was going to work the field. He was going to be a vision that had not been part of what the Jewish world looked like. And that new world did not include Shabbos, it did not include Kashrus, it did not include Torah, it did not include mitzvot, and it did not include God himself. Not part of the picture. The Zionists then also, Echad Ha'am, which was a pen name for Asher Ginsberg, also late 1800s, died in 1927, he created into a cultural movement that was going to glorify the Chalutz. The Chalutz is a picture you've all seen. It's the pioneer. He's got that little white hat. He's got a hoe on his shoulder. He's eating an orange or a, what are those classic, No, you know those. You know that fruit. It's always holding one of those savra. And it was glorifying that. That was the picture of the Jew, working the field in his shorts and t-shirts and sandals, wearing that little hat. That was the image of the old image of the Jew, the stooped over, bearded, you know, old Jew with his book. We're done with that. This is going to create a new entity. The kibbutz, the socialist kibbutz, the utopian world, we spoke about this last week. Not only were we going to create a new Jew, we're going to create a new world. Because this is going to be the utopian redemption that we've been waiting for. And in this land, with our Jewish socialists, we are going to create that perfect place, the secularized Jew, the modern Jew, and everything about the exile was all bad, and it was if we're going to erase 2,500 years of history, 2,500 years of tradition, 2,500 years of lessons learned, and we're going to start fresh in the modern world. That was the early, early Zionist movement. Okay, now, as you can imagine, it was difficult for the religious world to believe that God was redeeming His people through this. This didn't fit. I'll give you a mashal. I made this up, so it's not perfect, and I'm still working on it. It's probably not exactly accurate. But if you could imagine a king who had a beloved prince, pride and joy, and the prince is sent away for training, and he's going to be trained to be a king so when he comes back home, he'll be ready to rule the kingdom. And the king, when he sends his prince away, promises him, I'm telling you, when you come back, there's going to be the most perfect princess waiting for you. She's going to be perfect in every way for you. She's going to be beautiful. She's going to be intelligent. She's going to be capable of leading with you. She's going to be capable of raising your children in every way, shape, and form. She is going to be here waiting for you. And the king, the prince, goes out and he's busy with his training for weeks and for months and for years. And he knows when he gets back, his bride, the princess, is going to be there for him, not only to marry her, but then to take over the kingdom. And he's waiting for his father to call him back. And while he's waiting, word arrives from someone else that says, your father is deathly ill, you have to come back. So he runs back, but it's too late. His father passes away before he can get there. And he's in the palace, and he gets a knock on the door one day, and there's a woman there, unsightly, unattractive, incapable in every way. Can't do anything. And she says, I'm the bride your father promised before he died. Marry me. And you look at her, she's spent a day or two in the palace, and you see she doesn't have it together in any way. She's nothing that your father promised. Nothing. Not in looks, not intelligence, not capabilities, nothing. She says, but your father, he picked me for you. Marry me. You're the prince. What do you do? I mean, seriously, think about it. What are your options as the prince? Your father's gone. You can't ask him.
Go back to training.
Okay? And you go back to training and say, I'm out of here. You're an imposter. Because I have a promise from my father who is not here for me to ask, but the promise from my father was that the woman waiting for me is going to be brilliant, is going to be attractive, and is going to be capable to lead this country with me. And you're none of those things. No offense. I always teach my children, whenever they say no offense, I say, don't even say it. Never start a sentence with no offense, but. Right? So that's one option. Your prince looks at her and says, you're an imposter. You're not it. This is the promise that I have, and you're not it. And if that's the conclusion that you reach, how do you treat her after you reach that conclusion? Right? This is an imposter trying to take the position of queen. How do you treat her? That's right, you shun her. Because she's an imposter. She's not just a citizen. She's someone who tried to usurp the throne. And she's an imposter. You don't treat her with tolerance. That's inexcusable. That's one option a prince can have. The other option a prince can have, he can go to the other side and he can say, my dad must know more than I think. This must be part of a process. It could be she's a work in training, a work in progress, and she'll get there. But I trust my dad. And I believe that if I marry her, we'll get there. Might not be tomorrow because I see she's not ready. But I believe that he knows what he's doing. And I believe her, and therefore I'll marry her. That's an option, right? It would take a lot of faith to have that option. Because everything in front of you says not that way. But you trust your father. Let's say you found a letter from your dad and she gave it to you. And it was clearly signed by your father. And he says, this is it. This is the one I picked. And you look at her and you read the letter and you look at her and you look at her. Okay, that would be easier if you had that letter. But if you didn't have the letter, it's a huge leap of faith. Even with the letter, it's a leap of faith. There's a third option. What do you think the third option is? Okay, find somebody else, which is really the first option. First option says, you're an impostor, I'm going to find somebody else. The third option is wait. Says, I'm not marrying you yet. I'm not marrying you, but I'll tell you what. I'll keep you around. I'm not going to treat you like that first approach that says, you're an impostor, get out, off with your head. I'm certainly not marrying you right now because you've displayed nothing of what would qualify you. But you know what? My dad was a good guy, and he knew what he was doing. And I believe you enough that you were chosen by him. I'll keep you around. I'll keep you around. We're not getting married so fast. Don't go looking for dresses just yet. Let's see how this goes. Let's see what happens. Let's see. Yeah, think that's an option? Yeah, another one?
The father provides a guideline on how she can get better.
Okay. So I made up the parable so we can come with a couple of ways. But I just wanted to paint it as a picture. So let's bring this down into our... It's 1900. The Jewish people have been waiting for the Messiah for 2,500 years. What's the picture of the Messianic era they've been waiting for? What's the picture in their head as they've been slaughtered century after century after century, as they've remained true to their religion and to their God? What is in their head when they say, next year in Yerushalayim, next year we'll be redeemed? Milk and honey and a land of peace, a land of Torah observance in the land of our forefathers. They had a picture in their head as to what it was going to be like. And it sustained them for 2,500 years through horrific centuries, one after another. In the exile, there will be a redemption. God will bring us back. And the way that it looked, a perfect functioning society, Jewish people all together, observing the laws of the Torah in sanctity and purity. And now it's 1903, it's 1913, and there's a revival of Jewish feeling towards the land of Israel, of going home, of resettling the land. And you look at the bride, they hate Torah. There's no God here at all. This isn't what he promised me. This is nothing but nothing of what he promised. That the leaders of the movement are irreligious, anti-religious, religious people hating Jews who want to create a socialist society with no shuls, no kashrus, no Shabbos. This is not the picture. Well, we have a couple of options. How does the religious world relate to facts on the ground that Jews are coming back, redeeming the land, resettling the land, and it doesn't look at all like the picture we were promised? How do we relate to that? Well, there were a couple of approaches, which is what we'll discuss tonight. The approaches that I just laid out for you as to how the prince can relate to this unsightly, incompetent girl in front of him is in essence what the religious communities did, trying to make sense of an anti-religious movement to resettle the land. Before we get to that, there were other streams of opposition to the Zionist movement, which came from non-Orthodox sources. Reform Jewry, for example, was very opposed to the Orthodox movement. The Reform movement had completely erased the concept of Zion, Jerusalem, from their prayer books already. It was not part of their world. They were loyal citizens to their country, particularly in Germany, where it was formed and was a stronghold. They were German citizens of the Mosaic persuasion. I'm a German. Well, you can't be loyal to another country and be a loyal German at the same time. It doesn't work. So the Reform movement was philosophically opposed to the concept of Jews returning to Zion because that had been deleted from the program. Until the 1960s, there were still reform shuls which refused to hold an appeal for the state of Israel. Israel bonds were not allowed in their shuls because it's not part of the reform movement. That's already shifted as well. The concept of Israel being around for as long as it has been and new generations coming and going changes everything. But in the early days, the reform movement, believe it or not, was very opposed to the Zionist movement. And the Jewish left, which we discussed last week, the Bund, the communist, socialist elements of the Jewish people, which was very powerful at the time, were also opposed for the reasons we discussed last week, that there is no Jewish problem, there's only a capitalist problem. There's a world problem. We need to solve the world's problems, and then by definition the Jewish problem will be solved. But creating a new entity called the Jewish homeland goes against the entire socialist communist manifesto of a united whole world. So there was a large... Now again, the early Zionists broke off from them because they saw how much they were still being persecuted against. But the movements as a whole were not supportive of the Zionist movement. But what's really relevant to us tonight is the religious response. That's the controversy we're here to focus on for the remaining time that we have. The three approaches to how to deal with the early Zionist movement, when the picture, the dream, doesn't look at all like the reality in front of us. I've been waiting and yearning for the redemption, and what's in front of me, unsightly. The first approach, I'm on page 3, is the radical anti-Zionist approach. The first approach that I mentioned, Prince looks at his bride and says, "You're an imposter. Get out of here." That's the first approach. And it came from a couple of different approaches. Number one, this idea of the return violated the oath of not hastening the end. We are not allowed to do so. I want to read to you an ad. This was printed in the New York Times in the 90s. This is from the same group that the descendants of this approach, but they express it so eloquently. I'll let them express it themselves, how this approach takes it. Torah Jewry sees its exile from the Holy Land as a result of a divine decree based upon the Talmudic oaths, which prohibit the Jewish people to travel en masse to the Holy Land, to rebel against other nations, or in any way to seek or hasten the messianic process by worldly means. We're not allowed to do that. It's a divine decree sent us out, and we can't do anything about it. The land was given to us according to God's will, and when our sins accumulated, we were exiled from it. This exile is, in essence, a spiritual state that cannot be remedied by any temporal means. Returning to the land of Israel doesn't help the state of exile. Hold on one second. Until God chooses to end history as we know it by redeeming us through miraculous acts, we are commanded by Him to live as cooperative, law-abiding, and patriotic citizens in all the countries of our residence. Accordingly, the Jewish people have no claim to the Holy Land at present. They have no right to conquer it or to rule over it. This is an approach that says, the Talmud says, we may not go back. Their interpretation of that passage of the Talmud, we may not go back. It was God who sent us out. It will be God who will bring us back. If it is human hands pushing the envelope, it is wrong. It's wrong to be there. We have no right to be there. And we will actively protest the Jewish people's presence there and support those who want to expel the Jewish presence from there. Because the redemption will not happen as long as we continue to be in violation of God's will by being a presence in the land of Israel. What's that? This is for sure Neturi Karta, this is Sadmar, this is Munkatz. This is an approach of, we're not allowed to be there. Because, look, this is the vision we have. Look at what's there. This is not it. This is not it. It's anti-religious. It's anti-Jewish. That's not redemption. It's not the picture of the redemption we had, and therefore whatever is here is an imposter. And we need to remove the imposter so that the true princess can be found. There's a lot of debate as to the order of things. So this is an approach that the order is going to be the Messiah is going to come through miraculous means and bring us back. And then, that's debatable. We had a class about that here also last year. So which one comes first? Who makes the first move? Is it the Jewish people return and Mashiach comes? Or Mashiach comes to bring us back? For most of the Jewish waiting period of exile, the understanding has been Mashiach is going to come and then take us back. That is this approach. They also brought in... Yeah?
Is there a label on that group that you just...
Yeah, today this is known as the Nituri Karta, Satmar Chassidim and Munkach Chassidim, which are branches of the same form, have this approach. There's an official group, it's based out of Canada. The ad was placed, I forgot the name of them. There's a group, whenever you see Hasidim protesting alongside Arabs, this is a group that they're from. It's from a group that believes it's intrinsically bad for the Jewish people to be there because it's against God's will.
So why are they there?
They're protesting, meaning like when the Arabs are protesting. Oh, some of them actually live there. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. Right now, there's a small minority. And again, the early 1900s is a much bigger group because we're living again post 65-66 years of reality that the land of Israel has been established into a state. We're talking 40 years before the state, in the early days when we could still actually debate this in theory. Should we, shouldn't we? That's why the Holocaust changed all of this. The Holocaust changed the theory of should we go back, shouldn't we go back to... Anyone who can go back has to go back, because where else are you going to live? And then it shifted the debate as to how to deal with it. But this is, again, it's hard for us to get it ourselves. This is literally where we're like sitting around a Shabbos table and we can debate it, we should, we shouldn't, because it hasn't happened yet. The Holocaust hasn't happened yet. World War I hasn't even happened yet, which destroyed European Jewry. So it's hard to get back. But the remnants of today are all based on these theoretical constructs which existed back then of this is wrong. Let me bring also, the Rami Rundberg wrote a letter to those who, this is in the 1200s, 1300s, wrote a letter to those who wanted to visit Israel, and he said, be careful. Beware of every transgression, because if he sins there, he'll be punished most severely. Because God supervises the land and watches over its inhabitants. He who rebels against the kingdom from within the king's palace is not the same as he who rebels outside of it. And this is an old statement. This is from the 12th, 1300s. This group, this first anti-Zionist group, brought in those statements and said, you can't just go back in mass. You can't bring regular Jews to live in the land of Israel. They can't handle it. The sanctity is such. You're living under a microscope. It's God's backyard. And you're going to found a state based on anti-religious Jews on a socialist platform who have no God? It's doomed to failure. Those who go will be destroyed. You can't make it there. They were concerned that the Jewish people would be secularized, and that Zionism would become a religion into its own right. Which happens. Those of you who were on the Tanakh tour with me a couple years back, if you remember, we went all the way up north. We were overlooking, was it Jordan we were overlooking at the very top? We met with Lebanon. And we met with a secular Jew from Chicago who made Aliyah when he was like 18, 19 years old. And he settled on that hilltop and he said, this is where I'm going to die. If they attack, I don't care. I'm not going anywhere. I'll be buried right here. And he said, you might remember, in the course of his discussion, he says, this is my religion. You all have your God and your mitzvot and your shofar and your shuls. This is my religion, he said. I'm settling this land. And that was the sentiment. He literally was the embodiment of the fear that the religious community had that Zionism would become a religion. You don't have to worry about Shabbos anymore as long as you support the land of Israel. I don't have to worry about kashrus. I give money to the JNF. I'm good, right? Well, it's good that you give the JNF, but that doesn't mean you're good. Because we have a concert, we have a belief system beyond that, and the fear was that Zionism would become a religion unto itself, which it did. That was the fear. Reb Tzadik HaKohen himself was one of the 1800s, the great Rabbanim there, also wrote that he said it'll work. Chutzpah, there's a certain chutzpah that was going to take over the world, the Gemara says, in the times of the Messiah, and it'll be successful, even chutzpah against God's will, even though he wasn't for it, but he saw that there was going to be that. Now this is again today, those of you following politics today in the land of Israel, so there was a vote in Beit Shemesh. Anyone following any of this? There's a major, major vote in Beit Shemesh. They had to do a revote because the first one was filled with voter fraud, whether or not a Haredi or a non-Haredi would be elected. And in Beit Shemesh there's a large sect of Satmar Chassidim who are of this group, of this belief, this anti-Zionist belief, and they refuse to acknowledge the government. They refuse to acknowledge anything about it because it's an illegal government. So they refuse to vote. Even though the vote would have benefited them in every other way to be able to get the Haredi mayor elected, because philosophically, today, 2014, they won't vote. won't be part of anything. Because it was such an important vote, they allowed the women to vote, because, you know, that doesn't count anyway. But they refused to vote until today. 2014, this is still a strong sentiment. It's this first approach that says, this princess is an imposter. It's not my princess, because my father the king promised me this. And I've been holding on to that promise while I've been away the whole time, and when I get home, and you're not it, this isn't right. It's not right. And because it's not right, I can't deal with it. And I won't deal with it, because until you're out of the palace, I can't get the right princess in. That's approach number one. In the bottom box on page three, I brought, right after, I'll just tell you briefly outside, a support from the Torah, right after the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies. When the Jews are decreed to wander for 40 years, the Jews they mourned greatly, and they wake up in the next morning and they say, we're ready to go and take the land, let's do it. And God, Moshe says to them, you cannot transgress the word of the Lord, it will not succeed. Hashem is not with you, don't go. And they said, we're ready, we're going to go. And the Torah records, a group woke up in the morning, and they attacked to take the land, and they were all smitten and driven back. You can't take the land without the help of Hashem. Source, they lost. So all this is one approach. It's an approach that says, this is the wrong princess. It's not supposed to look this way. So finished. Okay, approach number two. Top of page four. Basically known as religious Zionist supporters. The early group days were known as the Mizrahi. Within the Mizrahi, there were two groups. The main group, which is the one that really won out over time, saw this in messianic terms. They saw this princess, and they said, whoa, you are quite unsightly, unattractive, and completely incapable in every way, but my father knows what he's doing. And this is clearly a step along the way, and I must marry you, and somehow through the marriage, this is going to work itself out. And the religious Zionists, particularly Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who we discussed at length before, we'll discuss next week as well, saw everything that was happening in redemptive terms. That every step was a step along the way. Everything about the Holy Land is infused with holiness. From the most secular, anti-religious kibbutz is settling the land, is filled with holiness, bringing us one step closer. Look at a quote from Rav Cook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. How is it, he asks, that the movement for concrete redemption in our time, including the settlement and conquest of the land and the abandonment of the abolition of the exilic existence, did not originate with the religious? How can it be, he asks? Why weren't the religious the ones who did it? Why was it the secular Jews who came back? How is it that from some religious spokesmen even withheld support from Zionism and the movement for redemption? And this comes from the opposite. Like, I don't even understand. How could the religious not support this? He answers, because they failed. Listen to these words. You will see the exact polar opposite. They failed to recognize that it was not that we mortals were forcing the end, but rather the master of the house, the Lord of the universe, was forcing our hand. That it was not human voices that broke down the wall separating us from our land, but the voice of the living God calling upon us to go up. Do you hear his language? Breaking down the wall, what's he referring to? Right, referring to the Gemara that says you can't attack like a wall. Think, it wasn't us. Don't you hear? Listen, listen, listen. Don't you hear? It's God's Word pushing us forward. You think it was the secularists that they were somehow infected with this disease called Zionism? No! God was pushing them. This was the hand of God moving history. This is the redemptive process. We've entered into a new era. For 2,400 years, exile. With the return of the Jews to the land and the advent of the Zionist movement, culminating with the founding of the state, we've entered into a new period in history. The redemption hasn't fully happened yet, but we've begun the process. That's significant what I just said. It's not just in theory. The redemptive process has begun. The Jews are back in control with sovereignty over the land of Israel. Is it perfect? Far from it. Far from it. No one deluded themselves into thinking that the state back then, nor today, is redemption. It's not, but it's a step along the process. And every step is filled with sanctity, filled with holiness as we move along the approach. So it's the polar opposite. First approach, let's throw that imposter out. Don't talk to her, don't deal with her. She's preventing you from getting to redemption. The second approach says, I mean, in my head, I thought she was a little bit more beautiful, but let's give this a whirl. And I'm going to marry her. And through the marriage, we're going to work. You know what? Maybe it'll be our children who'll be the next king of the world. I don't know. But this is what Dad had for me, and this is what I'm going to take. And so it was a full attachment, connection, buying into the program to change it from within. Many times in Judaism, we see this concept of things start off looking inappropriate. If you trace through the Chumash, the essence of the Messiah itself. What's the lineage of the Messiah? Starts with Lot, who has relations with his own daughter. It's traced through Yehuda, who has relations with his daughter-in-law. David, Bathsheba, there's this seemingly inappropriate behavior all the way through. Somehow God has to sneak holiness into the world. You have to go through the back door because it's so holy, it's so special. The forces in the world won't allow it in. But if I sneak it in like this, someone's going to say, that's not so holy, I'll let that in. The land of Israel, Jews returning, if the religious people would have tried to do it, no way. But a bunch of secular, anti-religious people, somehow it happened. Now it's here, let's make it religious. So again, there are so many streams within this religious approach, many, many streams, especially today. You can't even name them all. The different forms of religious Zionism, all of which have in common looking at the phrase Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu, the first flowering of our redemption. Redemption is a process. It's a flowering. It's going to start. It's going to take a while. Anyone who's on that trip, again, remember the trip we took to Israel. Remember we went to the fields. And I told you a story that I'll repeat here for everyone else. If you've never been a farmer before, or know nothing about farming, and you show up to a farmer and you say, I'd like a loaf of bread. So he's going to take a seed, a grain, and he'll take you out to the field, and he'll kick a hole in the dirt and he'll bury the seed. And he'll say, what are you doing? You're burying it. He'll say, wait. Inside the dirt, what's happening to the seed? It's disintegrating, it's breaking down. And if you could see what's going on, you would say, what's happening to my seed? Wait. And then it begins to grow, to germinate. And you see green, you say, oh, I get it. You say, just wait. Because when it's fully grown, I cut it down. You say, nah, you just cut it down, it was so beautiful. Just wait. And then you pound it, and you get the seed, and then you crush it into a flower. And then just when you think you can't do anything more to it, you add water, knead it into a dough, and throw it into the oven to burn. And when you throw it into the oven, that last step, you say, now you're crazy. You've lost it. Just wait. Because right at the right moment, when you take that steaming hot, fresh loaf of bread out of the oven, every single step of the way that was destructive, and look at what you get. And we're used to that, take it for granted, because we buy our bread at Kroger. But if you were a farmer, you would appreciate that. So there's a religious, this stream, this religious Zionist approach would say, we're there, we're at that last stage. And you know what? Whatever's here now, that seed, it needs to disintegrate in order to flower. Semach David Avdocha. We say in Shmona Esrei, the flowering of the redemption. It's a process. A constant breaking down, growing, breaking down, regrowing. That's how it works. That's how the world works. So right now what's here looks all bad. I know. But you know what's going to happen to it? It's going to break down. And then from that seed will germinate. It's a process. But it's a holy process. And it's begun. That process has begun. So don't you see that happening? So you have the two extremes from this is all evil to we've actually entered into the redemptive era in which the process has begun. It doesn't look right, but let's work with it. Let's work with it and make it work. We're going to talk about this next week. When we talk about the next week's topic is Rav Kook, and those who argued with him as to the nature of the religious element. How should the land be set up? But this is that the approach is it's all holy and good, and it's part of the redemptive process. There is a how do they deal with the oath? By the way, how do they deal with the oath? So there are a lot of different ways to deal with the oath. Number one is what we mentioned earlier, that, well, since the nations of the world didn't keep theirs, so we don't have to keep ours. You have approaches that range all over the place from the oaths were only short-term, they only applied in Bavel. You have the idea that we didn't do it really by force because, especially those, you know, post-Holocaust, after the UN voted, the nations of the world gave us permission to go. There have been lots of different approaches. We could spend an entire class on them, but we're not going to do that right now. Okay, there was within that group, there were those who just saw it as a practical plan. They weren't relating it to the messianic event. Not just, well, the Jews are in trouble around the world. We need a place for them to go. Let them go to the land. This is again before the Holocaust even. Okay, the third approach, which is the really the bulk of the Jewish world, is divided between numbers 2 and 3. You have the religious Zionist group today in the land of Israel, and then you have the Haredi world. Now, the Haredi world wasn't called the Haredi world in the turn of the century, but we're going to refer to them as this is their philosophy. They're in the middle. They don't hold like the Satmar Hasidim and the Turikarta that the land is all evil, that the bride is an imposter. They don't hold that this is it. This is the one that God gave me, so I'm going to marry her and make it work. They're in the middle. What was that third approach? You know, neutral. I'm not going to do anything. I'm not making any commitments. And the Haredi approach is summarized as follows. The state of Israel should be judged as every other historical phenomenon that's ever happened, and that is as follows. What is its relationship to Torah and Halacha? Is it good for the Jews and keeping Torah and mitzvot? Is it bad for the Jews keeping Torah and mitzvot? I'm not dealing with it in any other way. You're here, you're not here. How do I deal with the land of Russia? I don't know. Are you good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? Do you allow me to continue my observance of Torah and mitzvot, or do you prevent me from following Torah and mitzvot? That's how I judge if you're a good country or not. America, good or bad? I don't know. Do you allow me to keep Torah and mitzvot, or do you not? Land of Israel, same question. I don't care where we are. Do you help Jewish people observe Torah and mitzvot, or do you not? That's how I judge good and bad. It's a very straightforward approach. Rabbi Yeshua Hartman, who's been here before as a speaker, he once mentioned that he lived, I said this before on one occasion or another, he grew up in St. Louis. So his mother was European. So the St. Louis Cardinals won the World Series at some point. So he was dancing around the house saying, "The Cardinals won the World Series! The Cardinals won the World Series!" And his mother, the European, who had no idea baseball, they didn't know anything, asked, "Is that good for the Jews or bad for the Jews?" That's my frame of reference. I don't know how to deal with anything you tell me other than, I don't know, is there good Jews, bad, good news or bad news? That's all I know. So this middle approach views every event in history with a single lens. The Jewish people survive through adherence to Torah and mitzvot. Whatever historical event you give me, does it help? Does it hinder? That's how I judge it. So in the early Zionist movement, did it help or hinder? So if it hindered, I don't want to be part of it. If I could live there and it can help, fabulous. I'd rather live in the land of Israel than somewhere else. I could do more mitzvot in the land of Israel. But if it's a hindrance to my ability to do mitzvot, then I'd rather be somewhere else. And if I can be there, how do I relate to the government? Do I relate to it like a woman who's an imposter? Do I relate to it to my wife? Neither. You're just a foreign government. Because is this the redemption? No. Redemption does not come in this middle approach. And it's funny me calling the Haredim the middle, but for tonight's purposes, they are actually. In this approach, I'm not committing to anything. I'm not making you an imposter. I'm not making you my wife. Just, you're the government I live in. When I lived in Russia, I lived under a foreign government. When I lived in America, I lived under a foreign government. When I lived in Poland, I lived under a foreign government. Now I live in the land of Israel. It's a foreign government. What makes it foreign? Because it's not a Torah government. So I'm living in exile. It's exile in Israel. There are many sources, I brought one, that the philosophers within this movement describe that this is the most painful of all exiles. Because it's one thing to be in exile in Russia, and it's another thing to be in exile in Poland or in America, but it's worse to be in exile in your own home. It's more painful to be a foreigner in your own home. When you read today what's going on, you'll hear this sentiment. the sentiment of I'm the religious Jew, I'm the one observing Torah mitzvot, and I'm the foreigner here. This is supposed to be my home, but I'm an exile. Will I address the government? Will I take part in the government? Of course. Would I take part in the government in Germany or in Russia or in America? Sure, religious Jews do that. Why does a religious Jew in the Haredi world take part in the government in Germany or in Russia and America? Correct. What platform do they run on? Jewish platforms. They run in Jewish areas to help the religious Jews. It's the same thing happening today in Israel. It's not because they believe in the Zionist movement or they believe in the redemptive process, but if I could be the mayor of my town and get more for the government to help my people, I did that in Russia, I did that in America, I did that in Poland, I'll do that in Israel. In many of our minds, we look at that and we say, look, you're going to join the Israeli government and then you're not going to take part in the army? How could you do that? Did any Jew volunteer for the Russian army ever? If a Jew would be able to be a mayor in a town in Russia, would he do it? Of course, if he can make it better for his people, why wouldn't he? Would he then send people to the army? No, because going to the army doesn't help his cause. And he has a singular cause. His cause is, if it's better for the Jewish people, if it's better for Torah observance, then it's good for the Jews. This approach believes that we are in exile in the land of Israel. Again, in summary, the Neturei Karta Satmar holds the whole entity is evil. It's an imposter. This is not the vision or the dream that we've held for 2,500 years. Whatever is there is wrong. Get rid of it. The religious Zionist approach, again, I'm oversimplifying many different streams, but again, my oversimplification, the religious Zionist approach says, doesn't look like it now, but if this is what God's plan is, who am I to say against it? God runs the world in mysterious ways. Okay, so He began the redemptive process through irreligious, anti-religious, God-hating Jews. Go figure. What should I do? Let's join Him and make it religious. The Haredi approach, again, it's only in the middle when you compare it to Neturei Karta. In today's world, they're not in the middle, but compared to Neturei Karta, they're in the middle. They're not anti, as long as you let Jewish people living in the land of Israel get the most for their ability to learn Torah and fulfill mitzvot. Okay, we live in the land of Israel. It's no different living anywhere else. It's exile. Exile is exile is exile until the divine presence is returned to the Jewish people. We're in exile. So we function in exile the way we would. This exile happens to be in the land of Israel, and as I said, that makes it even more painful. It's even more painful for me to be home and to feel like I'm persecuted in my own land, that I have to struggle to keep Shabbos more in the land of Israel than I would somewhere else. I'm not saying that's right or not. I'm just saying that's how this approach feels. That how can it be that I'm in my own home and I'm a stranger? This is the most painful of all exiles. The Holocaust changed everything. The Holocaust changed everything because it changed what was a philosophical debate into a reality of we need a homeland to protect ourselves. It shifted the nature of the debates, but the debate is still there. When you go through, literally today, as I tried to do, literally today, in 2014, these streams of thought are alive and well. They exist. If in your mind you look at what's going on with the army situation today and you say, I don't understand. I know many of you, and myself included, have trouble understanding the approach of the Haredi world. I'm not judging anything tonight, I'm just expressing where they're coming from. They're coming from the approach that says, we're in exile. We're in exile under a foreign dominion, and it happens to be in the land of Israel. And what do you do in exile? How does a Jew survive in exile? Anything you can to survive and move your cause forward. What's their cause? The survival of the Jewish people, Torah and mitzvot. So whatever you need to do to push that. Now, to anyone who's on the side of the camp, of the religious Zionist camp in any way, would look at that and say, we're not the enemy. We're on the same team. We're in the land of Israel. We're making this pure. It's a process. Give us some time. We're working on it. Which is fine. That's an approach. But the two approaches clash on many areas because of that. And then in the background, you got the Neturei Karta waving their placard saying, you know, all of you, you know, get out of here. You're all evil. And you're the reason that the redemption hasn't happened because the Jews are in Israel and they're not allowed to be here. Some of them are. Well, most of them are not, but some of them are. What's that?
He would agree with Biden. Don't call yourself Jewish.
So, in any case, what I've done is, I hope, is laid out the controversy. And I hope I've made it clear, I mean, you knew this before I spoke tonight, how controversial this is. How the three approaches are so at odds with each other as to how to relate to the land. Or I should say that better. The land we relate to. How to relate to the government of the land. That when the government was founded, the state was founded, and the dream became a reality, and the dream looks nothing like the reality in front of me, how do I deal with this bride? Do I call her an imposter? Do I marry her and say, we're going to become beautiful together? Or do I say, you can live in the palace, and if we get along nicely, and if I get what I need out of you, things will be great, but I don't know what to do with you. You claim you're the bride, you're not what it looks like, so I'm not marrying you until you do. So as long as you don't, you hang around, I'll deal with you, I'll get what I can out of you, but you're not my bride until you look like her. And those streams of thought, again, an oversimplification, but are the approaches that we have, and they still manifest themselves today. And, you know, time will eventually, I imagine, figured this all out, but the Ribbono Shel Olam, Hashem is running the world in funny ways, and this is the land of Israel as we know it, as we're going through, and as we debate, Jews keep coming, and Jews keep coming, and Jews keep coming, and 6 million will be 7 million, will be 8 million, will we live in peace eventually one day, but these are the core of their differences, and they'll continue to manifest, that will go, the next three classes will all be built on this, as to how Jews figure this out. And as I mentioned, this is the controversy of our century. How do the Jews deal with this tremendous historical significant event of the Jews are back in the land of Israel? Well, how do we deal with that since it doesn't look like the way that it is supposed? Okay, there's much more to talk about, but this was just an overview. All right, have a great night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.